The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All right. Sorry about that. We've got so many people here that I think we are kind of melting the servers.
See, I think we're back online here. Great.
I am running for president of the United States to lead our great American comeback.
Despite some very embarrassing technical difficulties on Twitter, Ron DeSantis finally declared his candidacy for president. And he enters the race with an enormous war chest and name recognition. But he's also the object of daily rage from a familiar corner, Mar-a-Lago. Donald Trump refers to DeSantis, of course, as DeSanctimonious, and a lot worse. Welcome to the 2024 campaign. DeSantis gained attention nationally during COVID, when Florida refused many of the recommended public health measures. And since then, he's been pursuing political vendettas seemingly designed to keep him in the headlines. Last fall, he chartered planes to fly migrants to the wealthy beach community of Martha's Vineyard. And he's embroiled in a titanic legal battle with the Disney Corporation and its CEO, Bob Iger. Staff writer Dexter Filkins profiled Ron DeSantis in The New Yorker as his presidential ambitions were becoming quite clear. I talked with Dexter last year. Well, let's talk a little bit about his background. Who is Ron DeSantis? Where does he come from? What kind of person is he?
He's from Florida. He was born in Jacksonville. He grew up outside of Tampa in a town called Dunedin. And it's a working-class neighborhood. Working-class guy, went to public school. He was a great baseball player in Little League, where they won the World Series, and in high school. And he went to Yale on a baseball scholarship and then on to Harvard Law School. So he's come a long way.
Did he distinguish himself academically at Yale and then Harvard Law?
He did. He did. In fact, one of the more funny quotes that I got from one of his former classmates at Yale was, "Ron was so smart that we couldn't plagiarize off of his papers because everyone would know where it came from because he's the only one that smart who could have made that argument."
He's smart in what way?
More than a couple of people told me his memory is practically photographic, and particularly when I was having conversations about the coronavirus, that he was reading medical journals, and he'd read them once, he would digest it, he would understand it, and could have a conversation about it. Like, he's very, very fast.
How would you describe Ron DeSantis ideologically, and how did he become that way?
It's hard to tell how much of Ron DeSantis is ideological and how much is opportunism. He sounds like Trump, except that he speaks in complete sentences. And he's very, very articulate and very, very quick. But he's competing for the same constituency. So he's very, very angry at the elites, even though he went to Harvard and Yale. He's very angry at Washington. He's very angry at the politicians. And so he's kind of rallying basically the white working class of Florida, of which the numbers are still quite large. And he's angry.
And we're going to make sure that parents are able to send their kid to kindergarten without having some of this stuff injected into their school curriculum.
How did he become governor? My understanding is that although he's now seen as the dominant
political figure in state politics, obviously Trump himself is in Palm Beach, that DeSantis really kind of, he squeaked by to get in.
He squeaked by. He did. I think he won by less than 1%. And I think there was at least one recount, automatic recount. He defeated a politician named Andrew Gillum, who had been the mayor of Tallahassee. Very, very close race. And I think he benefited from the fact that Gillum, not only was he black in a state, former Confederacy, but also because Gillum came from the left of the party. And Gillum had squeaked in and sort of beaten a moderate to get the nomination against Gwen Graham, who many people believed would have fared much better against DeSantis. But DeSantis won just by a hair, but he's been a missile going straight up ever since.
What do you mean?
He has developed a style which is very visible, very theatrical, again, very angry, but it has made him a national politician. He really built, over the last couple of years, he really built himself and his persona, and I hate to use the word brand, but it's a brand, around the way that he dealt with the coronavirus. And essentially, it played in perfectly for him and his style, because he could say, I don't agree with Fauci and all the pinheads in Washington, and all they want to do is oppress you and make you wear masks and keep your children at home. And so he charted this very, very novel course on the coronavirus, and that's what made him famous.
Now, the COVID policy that you describe is not just, sheer obstinate ignorance. We've seen some of that in political quarters in the last few years, but something a little bit more complicated.
I had a long conversation with a professor at Stanford of public health, an epidemiologist named Jay Bhattacharya, who said he was sitting at home one day on a Sunday, and his phone rang, and it was Ron DeSantis, and he wanted to talk about the coronavirus. And Bhattacharya, very much like DeSantis, were kind of charting a slightly different course. And basically, and I'm going to make this a little crude, but it's essentially masking doesn't really work. The only thing you can really do is protect the elderly, which DeSantis did from the get-go, protect the elderly and basically try to ride the virus out until a vaccine comes. But don't kid yourself, there's not that much that we can do about it. And so what followed from that, naturally, was keep the schools open, keep the government offices open, keep the beaches open, keep the shopping malls open, and that's what Florida did. Very, very different from, say, New York or California.
And so I think the question is we can either have a free society or we can have a biomedical security state. And I can tell you, Florida, we're a free state.
And how are its statistics?
That's very, very interesting. I mean, kind of, they went up and down and up and down, and he caught a lot of hell over the course of the pandemic, but the numbers aren't bad. I mean, he's kind of, Florida is in the middle when you look at death rates. It's pretty much in the middle of the pack, right next to California. So, California shut down their entire economy, all their schools for 2 years. Florida kept everything open. So he's looking better than he did.
Now, another issue that's been crucial to his presence on the national scene is LGBTQ issues and how they're taught in schools. DeSantis has been out front on that. He passed a law a couple of months ago called the Parental Rights in Education, or the so-called Don't Say Gay law, where he supported it. What's the deal there? Tell me what happened and what role DeSantis plays there.
Well, I think, again, DeSantis has become a master at picking these issues that get everyone excited.
Hot button cultural issues.
Super hot button, yeah. And he's very, very good at sort of staking out a position and kind of pounding the table and saying, I'm not giving in to the liberals in the Northeast.
One of the stunning things about this episode is that DeSantis goes to war against a huge company in a state, against Disney.
It's remarkable. And he appears not to have suffered for it politically, not yet.
So describe the fight and what was the outcome?
So they hate it when you say the Don't Say Gay law, but that's how everybody understands it now, so I'm going to use that. The legislature passes the law. He signs it. Disney's response initially in Orlando, Disney World, is tepid. And the employees, many employees at Disney World, got angry at their CEO and said, this isn't enough. Like, we hate this. And so then the CEO came forward and condemned DeSantis and condemned the law. And then DeSantis basically went after Disney. And, you know, Disney, since it was built in the late 1960s, has basically had its own, basically it governs itself. If there's a fire at Disney World, Disney World has to put out the fire.
And they have special accommodations in some ways.
Yeah, very. And they govern themselves, essentially. They are left alone. And DeSantis just took that and threatened to zero out the entire special district for Disney World. And when you talk to ordinary, say, ordinary voters or people, his supporters, that's what they love about him. You know, they would say, you know, any other politician would have caved into Disney. You know, would have backed down and said, I'm so sorry, and not Ron.
So what's the purpose of the law in the first place?
I hate to speculate as to his motives, but it made a lot of headlines all across the country. And I think just the kind of headlines that he wants to make.
Which are what?
Which is, when you see him speak, he says, I'm anti-woke, I'm anti-elites, I'm against the press, I'm against the pinhead politicians in Washington. And so he can position himself as very much as a kind of anti-elitist. He doesn't really need to do all that in Florida to win. I mean, he's got that constituency locked up anyway.
So it's all national politics.
That's what it seems like. I mean, I think every person I talk to who knows him says this is a deeply ambitious man, and he's had his eyes on the White House since he was in college, and that every job he had was basically a stepping stone to the next one.
So you knocked on a lot of doors in the state of Florida in pursuit of a really deep piece on Ron DeSantis. One of the doors you knocked on was on the door of the father of Ron DeSantis. Describe that encounter.
Well, you know, I had just come from the CPAC conference in Orlando where Ron Jr. spoke, pounding the table. And I thought
it's the Conservative Political Action Committee.
Yeah, it's the big gathering. And so I drove to Dunedin, the little town where they still live. I looked up his address. He was there. I pulled over into a McDonald's and, like, changed into a nice, put out, like, a white shirt on and long pants. And I went with absolutely no expectation of success. I went and knocked on the door. And it's a...
As we learned to do as young reporters many years ago.
Yeah, you think, there's no way he's going to come out and talk to me. He probably won't even be there. And lo and behold, he did. And he was wearing an FSU T-shirt, looked like he hadn't shaved in a couple of days, barefoot, shorts, nicest guy in the world. I mean, absolutely, really nice. Didn't really want to talk to me at first, said I'm a little suspicious, I'll be frank with you. But then we had a really nice talk about his son.
How did he characterize him?
He said more than once, he said, well, Ron is stubborn. And he told a very funny story about him, which was, you know, Ron's a very good baseball player. And my gosh, I must have thrown 500,000 pitches to him when he was young, right out there in the front yard. And I think he only swung at 500 of them.
He likes to walk. Well, and Fox has had a huge role in DeSantis's ascent. You did a public records request and got a lot of emails between Fox News and DeSantis's office. What did you learn from those emails?
It's pretty amazing. It's basically a symbiotic relationship. It's kind of, you know, DeSantis needs Fox to become a national figure. Fox needs somebody to replace Trump. They kind of find each other. And so over the course of the emails, they're each suggesting programs to the other. They're practically writing the questions for each other. They're saying, God, that was great. You know, we should make you a host of our show. And so it is so close that, you know, the idea of kind of the traditional idea of journalism, which is you keep your distance. Journalists keep their distance from politicians. I mean, that's all gone.
Not so much.
Yeah.
And what's been the impact of his appearances on Fox? Is it quantifiable?
I think so. It's quantifiable in the polls, which are he is now far ahead of any other potential Republican nominee for the presidential election. And I think that's with the exception of Trump.
What is that relationship like?
As I was told, Trump believes, with some justification, that he created DeSantis. He endorsed him during the primary, and DeSantis, who had been far behind, kind of just took off and won the nomination. And so I think former President Trump expects a little bit of deference and a little bit more gratitude than he's been getting from DeSantis. As somebody put it to me, Ron refuses to kiss his ring.
Or anything else. Dexter, thank you.
Thanks, David.
Staff writer Dexter Filkins. His 2022 profile of Ron DeSantis is at NewYorker.com.